Donald Bartlemy didn't set foot in New York until he was already in his 30s, unusual for an American writer. At a Staten Island literary conference where Robert Lowell, Saul Bellow, and Edward Albee were the faculty, Bartlemy arrived as a customer. It was July 1961, and he wanted to get the great Mr. Bellow's opinion of his short stories, which was, it turned out, not a happy one. Bartlemy's narrative collages, his serious toys, infused with American music and French theory, seemed to Bellow to lack an inner life. Bellow was cranky already at having to do this conference in order to make his alimony payments. In a way, Bartlemy's work was all inner life, partially concealed, partially displayed. His stories are a registration of a certain kind of churning mind, cerebral fragments stitched together in the bricolage fashion of beatnik poetry. The muzzled cool, the giddy play, the tossed salad of high and low, everything from cartoon characters to opera gets referenced in a graffiti-like chain of sentences. Conventional narrative ideas of motivation and characterization generally are dispensed with. Language is seen as having its own random and self-generating vital life, a subject he takes on explicitly in the story Sentence, which is one long, never-ending sentence full of self-interruptions and searching detours and not quite dead ends. Like human DNA itself, with its inert junk viruses, concluding with the words, a structure to be treasured for its weakness, as opposed to the strength of stones. The story For I'm the Boy Whose Only Joy Is Loving You, whose lilting title refers not to the Irish ballad Bold O'Donohue, as Doherty insists, but to an old Bing Crosby song called Remember Me, ends with a character's memory of Tuesday Weld turning from the screen to tell him that he was a good man. He had immediately gotten up and walked out of the theater, gratification singing in his heart. When he is then physically assaulted, salt emerges from his eyes, and black blood from his ears and from his mouth, all sorts of words. A belief in language and culture persists indomitably in Bartlemy's sad, hip world, and makes life worthwhile and deserving of what Thomas Pynchon has called the radiant quality of Bartlemy's attention. The ultra-modern architecture of Bartlemy's childhood no doubt lent him confidence and comfort with the ultra-contemporary literary object. Poetry could be collected intact from the world, then stripped and compressed. A story could be a mosaic torqued to mirror human anxiety. One early story, The Piano Player, from his first collection, Come Back, Dr. Caligari, begins this way. Outside his window, 5-year-old Priscilla Hess, square and squat as a mailbox, red sweater, blue lumpy corduroy pants, looked around poignantly for someone to wipe her overflowing nose. There was a butterfly locked inside that mailbox, surely. Would it ever escape? Or was the quality of mailboxness stuck to her forever, like her parents, like her name? The sky was sunny and blue. A fillet of green silly putty disappeared into fat Priscilla Hess, and he turned to greet his wife, who was crawling through the door on her hands and knees. Yes, he said. What now?
I'm ugly, she said, sitting back on her haunches. Our children are ugly.
Nonsense, Brian said sharply. They're wonderful children, wonderful and beautiful. Other people's children are ugly, not our children. Now get up and go back out of the smoke room. You're supposed to be curing a ham.
The ham died, she said. I couldn't cure it. I tried everything. You don't love me anymore. The penicillin was stale. I'm ugly and so are the children. It said to tell you goodbye.
It?
The ham, she said. Is one of our children named Ambrose?
She made a moo and ran a hand through her artichoke hair.
The house is rusting away. Why did you want a steel house? Why did I think I wanted to live in Connecticut? I don't know.
Get up, he said softly. Get up, dearly beloved. Stand up and sing. Sing Parsifal.
I want a triumph, she said from the floor.
The placement of unexpected things side by side is not only the spirit of surrealism, but also the beating heart of both comedy and nightmare, and Bartlemy's work, despite its seemingly offhand oddness and its flouting of conventional storytelling, is capable of suddenly cohering in the marvelous way of Kafka. In the blackly humorous The School, death pervades all the group projects of an elementary school class as the children themselves both decry and embrace it. In Me and Miss Mandible, a grown man awakes to find himself back in the fourth grade. These two stories, along with Shower of Gold, whose setting is a television game show, are perhaps Bartlemy's most widely anthologized stories, more conservatively structured and screamingly funny, although, apart from the undercurrent of horror, they are not especially typical. Most of Bartlemy's stories are In the Way of the Piano Player or For I'm the Boy, sites of linguistic clustering, cobbled verbal scraps collected jazzily in Joycean fashion from the buzzing urban culture to which he was so alert. He was a rainbow coalition ventriloquist, and his denser stories perhaps gasp for air. That his first three decades were spent in Houston, a sprawling city without zoning ordinances and resplendent with surreal juxtapositions, billboards next to churches next to barbecue shacks, must have been a deep and abiding influence, though his early reading of Mallarmé is usually given the credit. Although at times his stories seem similar to a political sketch by, say, Mort Saul or Lenny Bruce, although Bartlemy admired S.J. Perlman, Perlman did not return the love and actually went as far as to complain to the New Yorker about Bartlemy's work when it began regularly appearing there. At other times in their experimentalism and absurdist poetic chat, girded with a plangent cry, they can resemble a cross between Gregory Corso's Marriage and the Guy Marks song, Your Red Scarf Matches Your Eyes. Bartlemy indeed loved songs, but worked hard to avoid any explicit sentimentality. Yet one can see how pure avoidance of sentimentality is impossible for him, and he often leaves it lying about in small shards for the optional taking. One reviewer called Bartlemy's literary terrain the cratered landscape of the broken heart. His short story, How I Write My Songs, is sturdy satire, but beneath it is the voice of someone who is broke and clinging to the stilted truisms and timbers of a wrecked commercial ship. The main thing is to persevere and to believe in yourself, no matter what the attitude of others may be or appears to be. Bellow's criticism to Bartlemy's face, do you really believe it's that hard for people to talk to each other? Shows that an avant-garde literary mind emerging from an emotionally laconic Texan male society to direct an art museum and read books translated from German and French, a collage in human form, a bricoleur in cowboy boots, was bound to be at least occasionally misunderstood. Geniuses can be the first to recognize one another, and just as often the last. In Tracy Daugherty's extensive discussion of Bartlemy's work, he has a literary scholar's predilection for locating, as if they were truffles, lifts and echoes and resonant touchstones, from Eliot, from Perlman, from Wolfe. This sort of detective work, as if it were mapping the genome of a narrative, may seem to some the downside of graduate literary education. Daugherty was once, in fact, a graduate student of Bartlemy's. To paraphrase our current poet laureate, Kay Ryan, why become a doctor of something that can't be fixed? Daugherty's determined textual sleuthing, the kind of thing an average reader can now do on Google, means to be respectful and interesting, but it strains and sweats and risks the inadvertently hostile result of seeming to want to undermine the originality of the writer, one whom Daugherty himself claims as radical and original, and at one point the nation's finest prose stylist. Daugherty's comparisons are labor-intensive and sometimes unconvincing.
The sentences echo Dostoevsky's Notes from Underground. He says even of an early newspaper article. And this gumshoe's persistence in tracking influences and mimicries, serendipitous or intentional, sometimes bogs the biographer down. Time ran an article on Black Orpheus and the French New Wave. Whether or not Don was thinking of this article, he clearly had in mind Walker Percy's The Moviegoer as he began reworking The Hiding Man. Like Ralph Ellison's protagonist in Invisible Man, Burlingame has freed himself from the received ideas of society and church. Even describing Bartlemy's early adult life in Houston, Daugherty can get startlingly sidetracked. In the first 7 months of his marriage, Don, in his capacity as an arts reviewer, could offer his wife a wide array of cultural excitement, whenever he could get her out, from an evening of Mozart piano sonatas performed by Paul Badura Skoda, fresh from the Viennese Conservatory, to the Latin singing of Joaquin Garay, best known as the voice of Panchito in Disney's The Three Caballeros, Disney's horniest animated feature, according to one reviewer. The inner core of the biographical subject is invariably elusive, the golden needle in the biographer's haystack of research. So what do we really want from a literary biography? Photographs? An index? A little gossip? Daugherty is cooperative on all these fronts. Among the many images collected in the book's glossy inserts, there are all four wives and both daughters. There are pictures of the young Bartlemy with the impish look of a game show host, replete with ironic smirk and a pair of thick-framed glasses. Later, bearded and brooding wanly, his boyish sparkle fading, he was said by Pynchon to resemble Solzhenitsyn. There are the beautiful Greenwich Village digs, and more than one cigarette thrusting toward the camera lens. The index is admirable in the hypnotic way of indexes, and for gossip, Daugherty lets us in on a brief affair Bartlemy had with Grace Paley. All that short story heat. Paley lived across the street from him on West 11th Street, and Bartlemy dedicated his sixth collection of stories, Amateurs, to her. There is also the tragedy of his third wife, who committed suicide by leaping off a roof in Copenhagen. But in reading about a writer's life, what are we finally asking for? A mystery to be solved? To desire a coherent creature to emerge from scholarly clutter may be too wishful. A literary subject, trapped within the awkward amber of someone else's prose voice, is offered up to the world in the stylistic rhythms and commonplaces of biographical storytelling. Whereas downtown writing seemed content with polemics, Don had always yearned for transcendence. This situation, unless twisted into satire, would only be anathema to most subjects, especially one whose ear was as attuned to the exquisite sentence as Bartlemy's was. A biography of a writer whose life is being given its enduring contours by the pen of a former student. Daugherty begins the book with a wonderfully memorable anecdote of an assignment and late-night call from Professor Bartlemy. Sets itself up to be a fraught endeavor. Moreover, scholarly baggage and enthusiasm can produce a quality of overstuffedness, making one long for the brisk, incisive stroll of a non-academic biographer like Daniel Mark Epstein, Calvin Tompkins, or Diane Middlebrook. What can be hoped for here, even if vainly? Suspense. Which is an unlikely effect in the life story of a famous contemporary writer, especially one whose life was essentially an ordinary bourgeois one. And yet, Tracy Daugherty manages to bring about this improbable thing. His book is a page-turner. One reads eagerly chapter to chapter, marriage to marriage, waiting to see what happens next. That Daugherty has ferreted out this element and put it to use is an amazing and rare accomplishment. 2009. Clarice Lispector. Before beginning this review, I took a quick unscientific survey. Who had read the work of Brazilian writer Clarice Lispector? When I consulted with Latin American scholars, well, only four of them, They grew breathless in their praise. She was a goddess. She was Brazilian literature's greatest writer. Further inquiry revealed some misunderstandings about her life, a life that clearly had reached mythic proportions, with amidst errors and idiosyncratic details. Still, Lispector was held in reverent esteem by all four, though one believed she had died tragically in a fire. Not so, although in her 40s, Lispector was burned on one side of her body, including her right hand, by a fire she accidentally started by smoking a cigarette in bed. Others were under the impression that she was a lifelong lesbian. Also, not so. On the other hand, when I asked American and British writers, nine, whether they had read Lispector's work, I could find very few who had even heard of her. Some had heard of her, they thought, but knew nothing about her and had not read her. Some had read her novels and recalled them as intense. Others had read a short story or two in some anthology or other. I myself have spent most of my life in this last, somewhat dishonorable category. I then went to Amazon.com. Is there a more coarsely ironic place to assess the public reception of a Brazilian woman writer? Where the customer reviews from Brasilia and Sao Paulo were glowing. But the American responses were often tepid, including one that suggested giving Lispector's novel, The Hour of the Star, as an April Fool's gift to a person you don't like very much, telling that person it's the best book you've ever read. Even a devoted Lispector scholar named Nadja Batella Gottlieb has titled an essay, Readers of Clarice, Who Are You?, in the collection Closer to the Wild Heart, Essays on Clarice Lispector, and has compared Lispector's simultaneously resistant and ingenious texts to the sweetened plaster that is used to kill cockroaches, a substance that lures the creature, then hardens it from within, killing from the inside out. This image is Lispector's own. To be a Lispector reader, Gottlieb implies, one must necessarily be caught off guard and then taken up, as if in a beam of light, toward a place that is not death exactly, but a kind of not-life. It is an enchanted sacrifice, though understandably, perhaps not to everyone's taste. From the start, Clarice Lispector, despite the South American sun, lived in the clouds and in cloudiness. She was to the public a charismatic obscurity, a witch, a recluse, a mystery, the Brazilian Sphinx. Her odd name made people think she was a man or working under a nom de plume, which she sometimes did, but Lispector was her actual name. She was a kind of feminist, but as someone who also at times wrote beauty advice columns and had a closet full of designer dresses, she was not a feminist's feminist. When later in life her work was called hermetic, and she herself a sacred monster, it was to her own great dismay. Elizabeth Bishop, who lived for decades in Brazil, thought Lispector was a gifted primitive, essentially self-taught and suffering from what Bishop thought of as Brazilian lassitude and unreliability. Though Bishop believed that Lispector's novels were bad, and that Lispector had read nothing except Hesse, Spinoza, Flaubert, and Agatha Christie, Bishop admired Lispector's short stories and translated several of them. There was a whiff of the diva about Lispector. Restless in a marriage that had no place for a sorceress's eye, hard on the nannies, she was just as restless in an art form that didn't really traffic in divas. She was a stern and prickly beauty, Slavic-boned and almond-eyed, a watchful expression of sex and hauteur residing simultaneously, as in the face of a cat. Her eyes had the dull dazzle of the mystic, wrote a friend. At the end of her life, several portraits of her hung over the sofa in her Rio apartment, including one by De Chirico, painted in war-torn Italy when De Chirico needed money, and Lispector was still a young diplomat's wife. Neither painter nor writer seems to have known who the other was. Midlife, she abandoned niceties. A demanding friend, she phoned people at all hours, including the middle of the night. She exhausted her psychoanalyst after 6 years of analysis, and befriended his young daughter instead. She cultivated an unnerving stare. When she confronted a Brazilian publisher over unpaid royalties right in his office after waiting for him to return from lunch, she was handed cash of such a small amount that she left the building in a fury and gave all the money to a beggar. She was mildly interested in the poor and wrote of them, ventriloquizing in their direction, as existential symbols. She spoke in an unconventional Portuguese that included a lisp, the correction of which she attempted but then shed, returning to the lisp. Her writing did not sound like the Portuguese anyone else was writing. The foreignness of her prose is one of the most overwhelming facts of our literary history, and even of the history of our language, wrote her friend, the poet Leto Ivo. She was a fragmentist in a shipwreck of introspection, though her subjects were nothing less than the nature of time, the nature of the self, and the nature of language communicating these natures. In French, she was viewed as a philosopher, and at times it does seem that calling her a novelist is a little like calling Plato a playwright. But when she attended a literary conference where her work was discussed in theoretical terms, she was a darling of deconstructionists. The renowned critic Hélène Cixous remains a Lispector devotee and, like many, refers to her as simply Clarisse. Lispector left the panel early, saying later that not understanding a word that was being said about her own work made her so hungry she had to go home and eat an entire chicken. She was a quiet torment to her translators, insisting that in her virtually untranslatable prose, every comma be preserved. Ronald Sousa prefaces his translation of her 1964 novel, The Passion According to G.H., by throwing up his hands. Lispector violated traditional expectations, he wrote, and such violation has robbed me of useful ways of structuring my presentation. This result may or may not be called translation, but then that undecidability is only fitting in regard to a work that may or may not be called a novel. First-time readers might be advised to start with the Giovanni Pontiero translations, which have been enthusiastically praised and do seem successfully to capture a real voice on the page. Oddly, Lispector's own translations of Agatha Christie, of Anne Rice, were widely considered careless and second-rate and done for the rather little money they paid. Much of this is set forth in the impressively researched new biography of Lispector, Why This World, by Benjamin Moser, a cultural journalist who for one intense period of his life forsook his day jobs at Random House and Harper's and made Lispector his raison d'etre, traveling the world to every place she had been and creating an international history of the years 1920, when Lispector was born, to 1977, when she died. Moser's is a well-written and remarkable book, and almost everything I can now say about Lispector's life derives from it. Lispector, the youngest of three beautiful and brilliant girls, came to Recife in the northeastern part of Brazil when she was five, a self-described Russian immigrant, actually Ukrainian, with her syphilitic mother and would-be mathematician father. They were escaping the Jewish pogroms that in the 1910s persisted in the villages and woods of the countryside of her birth. Her mother's disease was contracted when she was raped by a gang of Russian soldiers. Only at the end of Lispector's life did she discover that her mother, who died when Clarisse was nine, wrote too, keeping private journals. Lispector's older sisters were writers as well. Nonetheless, she began as a law student and then a journalist and remained a journalist throughout her life, and in some ways remained a lawyer as well, in that much of her fiction involves seeking the precise words for crimes and interrogating the moral intricacies of facts. She married a career diplomat who was stationed in northeastern Brazil, which was a strategic Allied base in World War II, and then later in Naples, Bern, southern England, and Washington, D.C. Though the life of a diplomat's wife might seem the perfect one for a writer, did it not work for Mary McCarthy? With its travels and staff, its only burdens being residents away from home and having to be polite all the time. She chafed, both as a dutiful diplomatic wife and later as an intellectual among intellectuals. She learned to say, "Isn't that nice," as the former, and "I don't know," as the latter. And although she was initially good at polite appearances, after 2 decades it all proved a kind of soul death. Freedom versus duty is an early theme in her work. Her private life as a writer was not entirely taken seriously by her husband, and so she left him, and with their 2 sons went back to Brazil, the only country that knew her work, and where her first book, Near to the Wild Heart, drawn largely from her own childhood, had been a critical sensation just before she left. In many ways, she did not return soon enough for happiness. She arrived in Rio as a divorced middle-aged woman with 2 sons, one of whom was schizophrenic. Solitude, social awkwardness, and concern for her son all infected her well-being. She became obsessed with an almost childlike desire to belong, and friends were driven away. Brazilian culture in the 1960s was heating up, and everything from bossa nova to political activism made Rio an exciting place to be. But fiction writers could not make a living there. Nonetheless, the specter resided in a fashionable part of Rio at one end of Ipanema Beach, with a live-in maid. She collected a generous amount of alimony, wrote journalism, ghostwrote a starlet's glamour column. Also under a pseudonym, she became a paid agent of Pond's, using a beauty advice column to extol the virtues of the company's skin cream. There, I've buried the lead. Lispector's uncategorizable work causes the reader to mimic her own processes. That is, her sentences are often in search of themselves and are constructed from the very casting about that a reader may undergo in having to find a term that is suitable to describe them. Zadie Smith has proposed constructive deconstruction, as opposed to a tradition of lyrical realism. I would suggest epiphonic collage, or, on less receptive days, expressionistic journaling. The Jewish mysticism that is sometimes attributed to Lispector has much to do with the feeling in her work of chasing after a fleeing god, though her most compelling deity was language in service of the mind self, from which language, too, for Lispector, has stepped away and required summoning back. Language, for her, was the self-slight. Moser never once uses the word narcissism. She worried it with self-consciousness, like a cat with a slippery mouse. The great neutral reality of what I was experiencing outstripped me in its extreme objectivity. I felt unable to be as real as the reality that was reaching me. Could I be starting in contortions to be as nakedly real as what I was seeing? The Passion, according to G.H. Even in her first book, published when she was 19, she was fond of the exquisite abstraction. The dark, murky night was cut in half, separated into 2 somber blocks of sleep. Where was she? Between the 2 halves, seeing them, the half she had already slept and the half she still had to sleep, isolated in the timeless and in the spaceless, in an empty gap. That interval would be discounted from the years of life. Near to the Wild Heart. Furthermore, her relationship to animals grew increasingly spiritual, taking Spinoza's pantheism into the heart of both her life — dogs were often her closest friends — and her work. In some of her narratives, animals seem a stay against the abyss. Other times they reflect that abyss in their eyes, in a manner resembling a destroying lover. She sometimes pits an animal and a person in a dialectic of mutual assassination. She is interested in the complexity of a creature, the eyes of a cockroach, the mute, humid hippopotamus, cats mistaken for suckling pigs. Theirs is a world that sees no danger in being nude. One of her finest stories, The Buffalo, from her collection Family Ties, takes place in a zoo, its closing notes of love-maddened self-mutilation, are reminiscent of the brutal ending in Elfriede Jelinek's The Piano Teacher. "Careful, nature thinks," is one of her oft-quoted lines, as is, "Do not mourn the dead, they know what they are doing." The specter reads as a lively intelligence, sometimes veering toward hysteria, then falling back, as if in a faint, and flattening to aphorism and pronouncement. Psychology and setting, by and large, remain vague. Such modernisms are dispensed with in favor of starkness, tragicomic paralysis, and crying out. She is a postmodernist of some sort, but Moser, perhaps wisely, does not attempt any label at all. He discusses her work in great detail, book after book, with sympathy and insight, and admirably eschews jargon, though he underemphasizes her wit. Lispector was terrifically funny, but it seems this is not made much of by anyone writing of her, though it is essential to the vitality of much of her prose. "Near to the Wild Heart" begins its second paragraph. "Resting her head against the cold, shiny window pane, she looked into the neighbor's yard, at the great world of the chickens that did not know they were about to die." In The Hour of the Star, the narrator announces, "The action of this story will result in my transfiguration into someone else and in my ultimate materialization into an object. Perhaps I might even acquire the sweet tones of the flute and become entwined in a creeper vine." In The Apple in the Dark, written in Chevy Chase, Maryland, just before she left her marriage, a black humor, conveyed through decrescendo and juxtaposition, is the offsetting fruit. "Ah," she said with simplicity, "it's like this. Let's say someone is screaming, and then someone else puts a pillow in their mouth so they don't have to hear the scream. Because when I take a pill, I don't hear my scream. I know I'm screaming, but I don't hear it. That's how it is," she said, adjusting her skirt. Even her letters are witty. Of a negative review, she wrote that the particular critic acts like the man who beats his wife every day because she must have done something. From Bern, the land of cuckoo clocks and snow, she wrote her sister, "This Switzerland is a cemetery of sensations." If there are other weaknesses in Moser's biography, they are largely organizational. There are repetitions as well as subjects that once begun are then dropped. The character and nature of her marriage seem almost completely missing for 22 chapters, as is, to a lesser degree, her relationship to her sons. Although we do see her observing her boys and writing down their cute remarks and notebooks, her relationship to mothering veers from being primary to less than secondary, and then back again in a flash. Her love life seems to go almost completely out after the fire in her 40s, and her lifelong attachment to the handsome gay poet Lucio Cardoso has unexplained hiatuses. Also, the smitten translator Gregory Rabassa's much reprinted line that Lispector was "that rare person who looked like Marlene Dietrich and wrote like Virginia Woolf" is never questioned for its sexism. For example, is beauty a contraindication of an intellectual life? Would anyone say this of Hawthorne, Fitzgerald, or Camus? The remark irritated the specter mostly because she had never read any Wolfe. Moser is impressive, however, in his interest in and take on Brazilian politics. Providing authoritative historical backdrop is his forte. And though Lispector wasn't especially political, after the military coup of the 1960s, she joined in protest with other artists and with young people with whom she felt like-minded on everything. She clung to young people. The strongly anti-communist Elizabeth Bishop, on the other hand, seemed to distrust the young and supported the military coup, which may come as a surprise to her admirers. Moser would like us to see Lispector's death at 57 of ovarian cancer as a literary symbol. He places it in a metaphorical system of eggs that runs through Lispector's work. "The chicken exists so that the egg may traverse the ages," she wrote in The Egg and the Chicken 1. "This is what a mother is for." But her illness seems less significant as figuration than it does as a disease that disproportionately afflicts Ashkenazi Jewish women. In other words, despite everything, a Jewish death. As was her own mother's, which Lispector never stopped mourning, and this, according to her latest biographer, more than anything else, informed the long, artful wail of her work. 2009. Barack Obama. In 2008, Barack Obama's new book was Change We Can Believe In, but for most of the reading public, all of his books were new, and his early memoir, reissued, had begun to be read widely that same year. Unlike Change We Can Believe In and The Audacity of Hope, Dreams from My Father was not a book about policy. It was written before the politician who wrote the others had even been hatched. Hatched as a plan rather than as a creature. Dreams from My Father contains Obama's most spellbinding writing and was the book most Americans were talking about in 2008. It offers a vulnerable portrait of the boy who became the man, even as it underscores that boy's toughness and makes resilience its theme. First published in 1993, when Obama was 31 and selling very few copies, before the bulk of its first printing was then pulped, a signed first edition now sells for five figures or sometimes six. When thinking of Dreams from My Father, it is sometimes hard to banish thoughts of the missed investment opportunity this 16-year late reading involves. For those of you who missed out on this deal, get in line and we will pool our dimes to hire a cheap hypnotist who will rid this from our minds so that we can concentrate on what is more important, or at least more literary. Dreams from My Father is surely, ironically, via its partially telescoped pacing and its storytelling license generally, one of the truest glimpses into Obama, the young man and the young boy. Written when Obama wanted to be a writer rather than commander-in-chief, and when he was thinking of readers rather than voters, it offers a candor and vividness one will not see in a more straight-ahead political memoir. There are sex and drugs, but they are completely unsensational. He is matter-of-fact and unself-pitying, even if self-pity might be considered a thematic corollary to his subject of identity. Unlike his later books, which are agendas of hope and reform, Dreams from My Father is less about idealism than about boulders in the road. Does one smash them, climb over them, go around them? Napping or retreating aren't options. What Obama offers is an intriguing portrait of family restlessness, which afflicted both his parents and his grandfathers, as well as Obama himself, a restlessness that caused him not to shy from challenges, but to use boredom and frustration and good intentions to step up and over them. In Dreams from My Father, family yarns are unspooled and analyzed, as if they were indeed dreams, with a dream's strange fleeings and chasings and believable changes. One of the most memorable is of his 4-year-old Kenyan father running away with his sister, who was running away to find their mother, who had also run away. It is a heart-stopping tale of African village life. Equally stunning is the stoical story of the Indonesian stepfather who attempted to toughen the young Barack by boxing him in the face. If one is wondering who this new leader of the Western world really is, Dreams from My Father is the book to read. 2009. The Wire. Set in post-September 11th Baltimore, the HBO series The Wire, whose 60 episodes were originally broadcast between June 2002 and March 2008 and are now available on DVD, has many things on its rich and roaming mind. But one of those things is Baltimore itself, home of Edgar Allan Poe, H.L. Mencken, Babe Ruth, and Billie Holiday. Baltimore is not just a stand-in for Western civilization or globalized urban rot or the American inner city, now given the cold federal shoulder in the folly-filled war on terror, though it is certainly all these things. Baltimore is also just plain itself, with a very specific cast of characters, dead and alive. Eminences are pointedly referenced in the course of the series. The camera passes over a sign to Babe Ruth's birthplace, Titans on a Mencken quote sculpted into the office wall of the Baltimore Sun. Poe is not just street pronunciation for poor, to the delight of one of the Wire screenwriters, but implicitly printed onto one horror story element of the script. A phrase of Lady Day wafts in as ambient recorded music in a narrative that is scoreless, except when the credits are rolling or in the occasional end-of-season montage. But there are less famous Baltimoreans throughout. Local filmmaker John Waters is given an ambiguous shout-out in the final season, and he shouts ambiguously back in the DVD's bonus features. And all are part of the texture and mythology that The Wire's producers are putting on display, both with anger and with love. The dartboard in a union boss's office in the series' second season features a photo of the former owner of the Baltimore Colts, who moved the team to Indianapolis in 1984. Scenes shot in Baltimore churches use the actual congregations. Real-life hot dog joints, Pollock Johnny's, now reside in The Wire's televised Amber. Actual purple-walled soup kitchens and cemeteries and neighborhood corners have acquired mythic status. More than one former reporter from the Baltimore Sun has written for the show. Baltimore heroin kingpins have cameo appearances, and one, Melvin Williams, who was arrested by producer Ed Burns when Burns was a police, as it said in Baltimore, is given the role of the deacon, which he performs arrestingly, with lines such as, "A good churchman is always up in everybody's shit. That's how we do." The list goes on. Baltimoreans name their pets after the show's characters. Some former members of the cast still roam the streets, now as celebrities. Young people use characters' pictures from the show for their own profile photos on Facebook. British tourists come to Baltimore for Wire bus tours. This array of consuming response, domesticating ownership, emotional identification, and devoted pilgrimage, is only part of the very many personal reactions to the show. The use of Baltimore as a millennial tapestry, in fact, might be seen as a quiet rebuke to its own great living novelists, Anne Tyler and John Barth, both of whose exquisitely styled prose could be accused of having turned its back on the deep inner workings of the city that executive producer David Simon, a former Baltimore reporter, and producer Ed Burns, a former Baltimore schoolteacher and cop, have excavated with such daring and success. "Where in Leave It to Beaverland are you taking me?" asks The Wire's homeless police informant Bubbles when driven out to a leafy, upscale neighborhood. The words are novelist and screenwriter Richard Price's, and never mind that this aging cultural reference is unlikely to have actually spilled forth from this character, the remark does nicely. So confident are Simon and Burns in their enterprise that they have, with much justification, called the program not television, but a novel. Certainly the series' creators know what novelists know, that it takes time to transform a social type into a human being, demography into dramaturgy, whether time comes in the form of pages or hours. With time as a medium rather than a constraint, one can show a profound and unexpected aspect of a character and discover what that character might decide to do because of it. With time, one can show the surprising interconnections within a chaotic, patchworked metropolis. It is sometimes difficult to sing the praises of this premier example of a new art form, not just because enthusiastic viewers and cultural studies graduate students have gotten there first. Heroism, Institutions, and the Police Procedural, or Stringer Bell's Lament, Violence and Legitimacy in Contemporary Capitalism, chapters in The Wire, Urban Decay, and American Television, but also because David Simon himself, not trusting an audience and not waiting for posterity, in his own often stirring remarks about the show in print interviews, in public appearances, and in audio commentary on the DVD version, has not just explicated the text to near muteness, but jacked the critical rhetoric up very high. He is the show's most garrulous promoter. In comment after comment, even the word novel is not always enough, and Simon and his colleagues have compared his five-season series to a Greek tragedy. Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides are all named, Homer's Iliad, a Shakespearean drama, a serialized narrative by Dickens, a historical document that will be read in 50 years, a book by Tolstoy, and Melville's Moby Dick. This leaves only journalist Joe Klein to raise the ante further. The Wire never won an Emmy? Klein is shown exclaiming in the DVD features on the final episode. The Wire should win the Nobel Prize for Literature. It could have, if we'd done everything wrong, been a cop show, Simon has said. And in its admirable and unblinking look at accursed people, America's largely black and brown urban underclass, it is arguably biblical, Dante-esque, and, masterpiece theater be damned, more downstairs than upstairs. Despite Simon's assertions, however, the series has some origins in legal and police shows, such as L.A. Law and Hill Street Blues, not to mention Burns and Simon's own Emmy-winning The Corner, 2000, a rather shapeless precursor, a faux documentary about poverty and drugs in the mostly black neighborhoods of West Baltimore, filmed with a handheld camera and a blues soundtrack, as well as Homicide, based on Simon's own book about the Baltimore Police Department, which ran from 1993 to 1999. The Wire is the polished, mature version of efforts begun before. It is not entirely sui generis, but it is beautifully evolved, nor is the force of the conventional medium entirely absent. Although there are no breaks for commercials, one feels the pressure and shape of an hour imposing itself on each episode, even if the plot of each remains unresolved and the pacing broodingly languorous despite sharp-edged cutting. The Sopranos helped prepare the way for this format as well. Though the nature and mood of The Sopranos is essentially comedic, a family drama laced with amusing and operatic artifice, as is the current AMC series Mad Men, recognizable authenticity, new and trenchant social commentary, and tragic class warfare have not really been high on the agenda of any other cable series, and it is a source of some bitterness for The Wire's creators that it never had the wide audience that these other series have had. Simon uses an analogy of white flight to explain it. White people will tolerate up to 8% of the neighborhood being black before they begin to leave, turning the neighborhood into a black one. The Wire's cast is over 60% black, and the white viewer flight was almost immediate. A teenage actor who plays one of the middle schoolers of the show's fourth season, and who was not privy at the time to Simon's analysis remarks of the show's lost viewers, the messed up thing is they can't handle the truth. The Wire, of course, is a deliberately far cry from Adam 12 and Dragnet, the cop shows of Simon's childhood. Its newness as a narrative art form is underscored most convincingly by its power on DVD, where it can be watched all at once, over 60 hours. This particular manner of viewing makes the literary accolades and the comparisons to a novel more justified and true. On the other hand, so engrossing, heart-tugging, and uncertain are the various story arcs that watching in this manner one becomes filled with a kind of mesmerized dread. In this new motion picture format, the standard consoling boundaries and storytelling rhythms are dispensed with, mostly. One is allowed a wider, deeper portrait, a panorama of entrepreneurial crime, government corruption, a harassed underclass, and faulty institutions of every sort, sprawling portraiture that aims at inclusivity. Even though its city hall has been mum, Baltimore's police department has given The Wire its endorsement, as have the kids of East and West Baltimore. Moreover, the show's themes can seem reiterated everywhere in the world,
from out-of-work shrimpers and auto workers to the meth cookers of the Ozarks to the poppy growers of war-torn Afghanistan. Oddly, Hamid Karzai has two brothers who live in the Baltimore area. It is sometimes hard to think about the world's troubles without thinking, this is just like The Wire. In exposing the nerves, fallout, and sealed fates caused by a remorseless breed of capitalism and its writing off of whole swaths of the populace, and by insisting on its universality as a subject, The Wire has much in common with great political drama everywhere. The plays of George Bernard Shaw, in which rich and poor are both given language, come to mind. The newly elected mayor of Reykjavik will not allow anyone in his political party unless they have watched all five seasons. The mayor of Newark is also a fan. So is Barack Obama, whose favorite character is the gay drug dealer robbing gunslinger Omar Little, a new hero in Queer Studies, one of the few characters in the show who honors a code, and the only one whose ongoing motivation is love for another person. In the intricate network of The Wire, the storylines derive from the worlds of street-corner drug dealers and big-time traffickers, the police of homicide and drug enforcement and special crimes, the in-office brass, the dock workers who knowingly and unknowingly unload the drug shipments, the union leaders, the foreign suppliers, the public schools, the newspaper, the mayor's office, the city council, the lawyers and judges of the criminal justice system, the prisons, the soup kitchens, the rehab facilities, and the group homes with their revolving doors. This is the metaphorical wire that connects all the various institutions and habitats of the city. It also refers to the high wire act of brave policing and honest work, difficult and rare. More literally, the title signifies the wiretap that narcotics detectives are constantly trying to get judicial consent for and then set up before the dealers, drug lords, hoppers, the lowest level drug dealers, lieutenants, and other soldiers, get wind of it and switch to a different system. At one point, with their cell phone codes cracked and with the detective successfully up on the wire, the players in the game, as the drug business is called, are either not using phones at all or else tossing them away after every use. Not only does The Wire demonstrate the ingenuity of dealers and detectives as they elude each other, but surveillance itself becomes the show's metaphor for what drama does in listening in on the world. It also embraces the Wildean sense of art's cleverness as well as its uselessness. Utility versus futility is everywhere at the center of David Simon's own view of the show. The great waste of human spirit and endeavor is dramatized, ironically, with great human spirit and endeavor. Season 1 introduces us to the Barksdale drug operation headed up by Avon Barksdale, his sister Brianna, and his right-hand man, the wannabe businessman Stringer Bell. The syndicate is operated out of a nightclub and then a funeral parlor, and when Avon is incarcerated, Bell attempts to hold meetings using Robert's Rules of Order. The result is a kind of skit. The business has as its primary territory housing project towers that are exploded in Season 3, an image deliberately designed to recall September 11th. Baltimore early on got rid of its old housing projects. Other American cities followed. This detonation is mostly viewed through the eyes of kids who are watching everything they've known reduced to rubble, and not unceremoniously. Stringer Bell, played by the African-British actor Idris Elba, is the enigmatic Gatsby figure, yearning for legitimacy, sporting wire-rimmed glasses, and attending economics classes at the local community college. He aims to become a legitimate businessman, a fate that is finally handed over to Marlo Stanfield at series end, though Marlo, played with eerie but prideful injuriousness by Jamie Hector, doesn't want it. Brianna Barksdale is one of several mother characters who give the lie to lip service paid to family values in a drug war-torn family by forcing their reluctant kids onto the streets to sell dope. In a white male-written show with few women, and yes, a stripper or two with the requisite heart of gold,
These dragon ladies, as one of the kids calls them, are part of a wire subset of women, marred, if not mutilated, by ambition. Still, these portrayals seem complex, emotionally ugly, and specific enough to be convincing. They are eye-popping to watch, especially Michael Hyatt as Brianna, who demands of her son that he do hard prison time for the organization, and Sandy McCree as Delanda, who exclaims loudly that her son should be put in baby booking where he might learn to be a man. These women, not drug-addled themselves, eat up the screen, even when they are quiet and must merely flash a look. Women who pimp their children are breathtaking in their monstrousness. Absent from the wire are any wise, reassuring matriarchs, and these bleak characters succeed in taking the viewer's breath away. Simon is not interested in viewer comfort. The conventions of prescriptive political fiction do not capture his imagination very deeply. He's far more interested in the unholy bargains everyone makes in the maelstrom of societal injustices. For a feminist heroine, the show has only the quite imperfect detective Kima Greggs, and only because in her strength, humor, passion for work, and apparently secure hold on her biracial identity and lesbianism, she is slightly better than almost anyone else. Each season explores an institution that has gone hollow with gamesmanship. Most of season two focuses on Baltimore's dock workers, particularly Frank Sobotka, played with a smolder and a fat suit by baby-faced Chris Bauer. A union head who stares out at Baltimore's abandoned mills and grain piers and notes that they are now condos. His torment and lament that this country once made things is the nation's own. His particular fate is a tragic one, Shakespearean in its emotional mix of small onstage relatives and large offstage forces, and his relationship with his nephew is one of several uncle-nephew relationships in The Wire, Avon and D'Angelo, Proposition Joe, and Cheese, that wordlessly announce the gaping holes left in families hit by law enforcement and hard economic times. Season 3 introduces the politicians and Season 4 the school system and the children it fails. Season 5 concentrates on the diminished and compromised role of journalists. The most intriguing phrase Simon has used regarding The Wire is to say that it is about the death of work. By this he means not just the loss of jobs, though there certainly is that, but the loss of integrity within our systems of work, the juking of stats, the speaking of truth to power having been replaced with speaking what is most self-serving and pleasing to the higher-ups. In a poker game with the mayor, one folds on a flush to allow the mayor to win. As opposed to the freelance stick-up man Omar, who, beholden to no one, shows up at a kingpin's poker night with two pistols and the Dennis Lehane line, "I believe these four fives beat your full house." Police departments manipulate their stats for the politicians. Schools do the same. Newspapers fake stories with their eyes on prizes and stockholders. Moreover, in the world of The Wire, almost everyone who tries to buck the system and do right is punished, often severely and grotesquely and heartbreakingly. Accommodation is survival at the most basic level, although it is also lethal to the soul. Ideas are no good without stories. Stories are no good without characters. In drama, characters are no good without actors. If the integrity of The Wire derives from the intentions of its creators, its power lies in an old-fashioned way in the brilliant acting of a varied and charismatic cast. Not to diminish the quality of the writing or the careful cinematography, but little of Simon's agenda would convince without the series' acting. This is how the humanity of various people is given its indelible life. The Wire's producers claim it contains the most diverse cast ever on television, and it is hard to doubt that. What depth of acting talent we have in our contemporary world, even if so much of it is not in Hollywood. Some of The Wire's standout performances are from British or Irish actors who mimic American accents so impressively that their real voices in the commentaries are startling. Of course, the Baltimore gloss is less convincing, and sometimes even absent, but the rest of America is fooled. Dominic West as the True Police, Jimmy McNulty is from Britain, Idris Elba as Stringer Bell, all